Made in the city. For the city.
We are Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, your fortnightly food and drink programme for Cambridge, with Matt Bentman, Ruth Reyes and Alan Alder. Thanks to Neil Whiteside for the last 2 hours of music and the new music generator.
Coming up on today's programme, we look at gluten-free foods. They are needed by people who are wheat intolerant, but some have a more serious condition called celiac disease. We speak with someone who has recently been diagnosed with it to find out more.
And then we speak with a number of Cambridge's food providers to find out how they cater for those who need a gluten-free diet.
We also pay a visit to a community cafe on Coldhams Lane that is helping those with learning difficulties train for professional cookery qualifications.
Andrew Webb is a food journalist. He's been on Heston Blumenthal's Great British Food Programme, Channel 4, talking about pies. He's presented the food programme on Radio 4, as well as being on it. His book, Food Britannia, you may know, has been out for a few years now, but he has a new book out. We review it and talk with him about it.
And Autumn was with us, and so Aoife Maxwell will be presenting her newly created cocktail.
At the end of the programme, Gigi Perry will be here to bring you the roundup of the latest food and drink news from the university, and we'll also have news from the city. So, let's begin.
Well, every week, I feel, I see the words gluten-free more and more in cafes, on the market, and hear it more in general conversations as well. So, what's it like to be a celiac disease sufferer for whom a gluten-free diet is vital? Ruth spoke with Grace Wright about her experience.
What does it really mean to be a celiac?
So if you're a celiac, it is a bit different to just being gluten intolerant. So if you're just intolerant, you might still have like very severe symptoms if you eat gluten. But if you're a celiac, you might not necessarily have symptoms. Some people don't have any symptoms, and they can be all types of symptoms. It doesn't have to be just stomach related. But basically, if you're a celiac and you continue to eat gluten, you're doing yourself long-term health damage. So your ability to line your small intestine attack themselves, because it's an autoimmune disease. So your villi attack themselves and they end up getting flatter, which then means they can't absorb nutrients from anything. So lots of celiacs, when they're diagnosed, will have vitamin deficiencies or anemia. And then long term, obviously, that risks various health complications like osteoporosis, because you haven't been absorbed the calcium. You're at risk of other autoimmune diseases, which the risk returns to pretty much normal, I think, once you're diagnosed and follow the diet strictly. But if you continue to eat gluten, you're increasing your risk of all those complications, which if you're just intolerant, you're not increasing. You're going to make yourself feel ill if you eat it, but you're not at risk long term in terms of your health. So when I was first diagnosed, I thought it was a disaster. So I didn't know anything about it at all. You're told you've got a chronic condition, and then the word disease is in there, which I didn't like. It sounds horrible. You have to give up lots of your favourite foods forever, suddenly. So it's not like something like Lent, where you're going to get it back. You have to give it all up, and that's it, gone forever. You can't have it again. So then it makes going to the supermarket actually quite traumatic, because you just go in and you think, can't eat that, can't eat that, can't eat that, and you're wandering the aisles, and you just think, I can't eat any of this anymore. It's a massive lifestyle overhaul. And you're obviously still feeling quite ill at this point, because you're just starting out and having to cope with the adjustment.
What does that mean when you go out to eat or when you self-cater? Like, is it really difficult to find things to eat?
Well, I've actually, like, now I've got used to it, I think catering for myself I find fine, because there's all the shops have a free from range. The only inconvenience is that sometimes all the shops don't have all the staple items like bread and pasta and things, so you might end up having to go to several shops, which can be inconvenient if you're sharing with people who do eat gluten, to avoid contamination in the kitchen. So it means you've got to have your own toaster or use toaster bags, and then you need to just wipe down the surfaces after preparing things so there's not crumbs everywhere. But, like, cross-contamination is the biggest risk. In America, I was having some gluten-free pasta.
Right.
And it was penne pasta. No, it was fusilli, that was it. And I found some macaroni in my dish, which obviously I knew was not gluten-free, so the dish was contaminated. They used the same utensils, transferred it into the dish. Yeah. Luckily, I was okay because I spotted it. I didn't eat it, but that could make someone seriously ill if they're celiac. Because even traces, if you're celiac, a crumb could make someone really ill. So in lots of places, they will provide a gluten-free cake. But if you're intolerant, you can have it. But if you're celiac, you can't really have it unless they've properly separated it. So if it's in with all the other cakes or positions, sometimes you even see the gluten-free cake on the same tray or plate. Or, you know, crammed in the same display. And if you're celiac, you can't have it because it might have been contaminated, which is a shame when they've gone to all the effort of providing it. So all you need to do is quite simple, really. Carlucci is a particular one I've noticed that's very good at it. You just need to put it on a separate plate with the lid over it, or just a separate plate, not crammed in with the other things, and then just have a gluten-free spoon with it. So Carlucci's have a serving slice, and round it they've just got GF spoon only. So then you just know, you feel reassured that it's safe. Eating out and about can be tricky. I normally carry a restaurant card from Celiac UK, which just explains about the importance of being gluten-free. You get to know a few trusted places that you like. I would research in advance and look at advice from other celiacs on blogs. Or some restaurants have a separate gluten-free menu, which I would tend to favour because it makes it less confusing for me to have to choose. It makes you quite anxious if there's nothing marked, because then you have to ask the waiter, who then has to go through it with you separately. And it's much easier if it just says GF next to it, or can be made GF, please ask.
So you were diagnosed in March.
Yeah.
Have you seen an increase in gluten-free products since then?
Yeah, definitely. Even though, so it's only been 7 months now, but even since then, there's like always new products coming out all the time, which I now find very exciting. Because before, you just sort of sit there and you'd be like, yeah, it's a croissant, or it's a pan of chocolate. And now it's like, oh my God, they bought a pan of chocolate. It's like an apple. So it makes eating more exciting. It's a positive way of looking at it.
Where can you buy gluten unexpectedly?
Okay, so obviously, you know, the standard like bread, pasta, blah, 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 that you know. So unexpectedly, sauces, you always must check sauces, because that might have been thickened with flour, or, you know, might have it in. Oxo cubes, you have to check those. So Oxo cubes do have it in, but there are stock cubes that don't, so you just have to check that. Hot chocolate, gravy, ground almonds sometimes, say.
Ground almonds?
Yeah. I bought a packet to bake a cake, and on the front it said, great for gluten-free baking. So I was like, great. I was halfway through making the cake, and it said on the side, may contain gluten.
What?
So obviously it's too late then, so pretty much anything that is in a packet or a jar or a tin, soups might have it in, you need to check. It makes you eat a healthier diet, because you obviously have to make things from scratch sometimes, and you have to watch your diet really carefully. It makes you more aware about what you're eating. And then actually the gluten-free community, the celiac community, is a really friendly group of people. So there's lots of good advice available. It makes you more interested in food, more interested in cooking and baking. There is worse things to have.
Yes,
definitely. It's more just a pain. It's annoying. But you can make it into like a positive, I think. There's lots of positives that come out of it.
Grace Wright is with us in the studio, and while we were listening to the interview, Grace, I think we were wondering about the cost of gluten-free food. Does it cost more?
Yeah, it's a lot more expensive than your standard food. So a loaf of bread would be about £3, or a cake could be £4. So it's a lot cheaper to make it yourself. And obviously it's also more expensive that you're having to cook separately to other people.
Yes.
So you can't eat them. You might not be able to eat the main meal, so you have to buy all your things to cook separately.
Yeah, one of the things that came out in your interview, actually, I thought, was the potential social impact.
Yeah.
Not simply impact on health, but social impact.
I think
as
that's
well.
Actually something that's one of the main impact about it, particularly because I was a student when I was diagnosed, and a lot of student social events are centred around food. So there'll be like sort of nibbles or a buffet. And obviously a buffet is completely impractical for celiac. You can't really... It's very difficult for you to participate in a buffet. But you can get around it by, I would just
take along some of my own food or something. You can still join in, but have like a little lunchbox with you all the time.
Okay, thanks.
Well, what do different cafes and bakers think about gluten-free products? Are they taking the necessary measures that Grace mentioned about keeping the gluten-free foods well away from the others? Ruth asked, in order of the voices that you will hear, Cake Ritual, Urban Larder, Black Cat Cafe and the Rainbow Cafe, their thoughts on gluten-free products and what they do to make sure that it stays gluten-free in their own establishments.
Yes, there's quite a big demand in this area for gluten-free cakes. The reason we do them is because we quite like flourless recipes that have a lot of ground nuts in them instead of flour. So for me, taste-wise, I quite like these flourless recipes, but at the same time, there is a demand out there for them because of food intolerance. They do sell quite well. They cost more to make than a flour-based cake, but I think the taste is there, the moisture is there, and the texture is there, so they're very popular.
Gluten-free, you've got lots here in Urban Larder. Has it been very popular?
Yeah, when I first opened the shop, which was over in Hope Street Yard, the lady that was baking for the shop would bake in gluten-free just because a friend of hers had recently been diagnosed with celiac disease. So she baked some fantastic food, all gluten-free. People were unaware of it, which a lot of the time they're still unaware that a lot of the food in here is gluten-free, because I think if you find a good enough baker, it doesn't make any difference. It shouldn't make any difference. In Cambridge, there's a very high awareness around gluten-free, whether it's just because the doctors are more aware. We have a really good clinic at Adam Brooks, specialised in celiac disease. It helps keep your weight down. It's less aggressive on the stomach. So a lot of people are choosing gluten-free food.
How do you make sure that the gluten-free stuff you have in the shop remains gluten-free and uncontaminated?
Well, yeah, we have. So if we do make sandwiches, it's a gluten-free bread. We haven't got a separate toaster at the moment, but I always ask people if they're happy to use the same toaster. If not, we use a griddle and grill, so sandwiches and things. Got a different cutting board, so it depends on the level of intolerance people have.
We have loads of gluten-free stuff. Everything that is gluten-free has to be kept away from anything that is like non-gluten-free. Washing utensils like before you cut like another piece of cake.
We have our menu basically labelled anything with GF, right. Gluten-free for celiacs has GF on it. We even have GF bread to go with the soups. We have regular bread, we have GF bread. We have lots of alternatives. We have dairy custard, we have soya custard. But we do a lot of gluten-free things. We've got main courses are labelled GF. So it's quite popular. I mean, not only GF, celiac people come here, everyone comes here, but it's another thing, you know, some people say, oh, that's good, this is the only place I can have dessert, or GF gluten-free bread with their soup.
Have you seen an increase in people ordering gluten-free, or is it always just been
I think so.
Like that?
You know, I mean, I'm quite old now, but in the 70s when I was at school, I don't remember anyone in the whole of my primary school class having a special diet. But now, there seems more people who are suffering from either irritable bowel or need celiac or can't have this or can't eat wheat or can't eat nuts. But all that stuff seems to have increased. I can't remember anyone in my primary school or school, for instance. Everyone just used to eat, I think, everything.
A lot of people can't choose to be, you know, they are celiac, and other people choose to be gluten-free. So there's a lot of people also choosing to be gluten-free because it's a lighter diet. People are getting cleaner and cleaner in what they eat. And at the moment, I used to sell a lot of bread, a lot of cakes. People now are eating less bread, less pastry. So you have to adapt to the market.
Thanks to, in order of appearance, Cake Ritual, Urban Larder, Black Cat Cafe and the Rainbow Cafe there. As people are cooking with a wider variety of ingredients and even just more aware of food intolerances, it's interesting to hear how the need for gluten-free foods can make cafes and even the supermarkets adapt. You can find so much gluten-free products around town, and these were just a few. Urban Larder has a freezer full of gluten-free pies, bakes and breads to take home as well. Do let us know of any other great gluten-free places you know of.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Andrew Webb is a food journalist and he has a new book out. His first was a very useful Food Britannia, and the new one is called Men's Pie Manual. And it's a really good book. I've spent quite a lot of time looking at it. It's got excellent recipes, well-explained techniques, and very useful tips. The writing is clear, it's entertaining and punchy as well. There are helpful photos too that show you what you should be doing, and if you find yourself in a morass of sticky dough, should it look that way? The photos help a lot. It's 188 pages long, it's well organised into 12 chapters on subjects like what sort of tools you'll need, different pastries, stocks and sauces, so the basics. And then there are different types of pie, so recipes for meat pies, chicken and game pies, fish pies, potato topped and cobblers, veggie pies, things that are almost pies, like beef Wellington. There's a chapter on sweet pies too. And then the accompaniments, how to make the best mashed potato. And that includes real detail, like which types of potato are best for mashing, making gravy, which in fact you really do without using granules, and making proper custard. At the end, there's a troubleshooting section, just in case things are going horribly wrong. There are recipes for well-known pies, like shepherd's pie, beef and beer pie, but also the unusual Norfolk plough pudding, heard of that? No?
No. Nope.
Beef and lamb bomb. You're a pie man, Matt. Have you heard of lamb bomb?
No, but just have that name, that description sounds instantly enticing. You want to have a go, don't you?
Yeah. Smoked mackerel rolls too, and historic pies like Dartmouth pie, humble pie. And Andrew's writing is uncluttered, there isn't too much of it, but nevertheless you do feel that there is a human being talking to you when you follow the recipes, which isn't always the case in cookbooks. And he's pretty direct too. I would suggest if you meet Andrew, don't ever get him started on the subject of tomato ketchup. The book is well researched, his interest in food history comes through well. And some of his techniques, I have tried some of these, are very good. Useful tips like using a pastry dibber, sandpapering, chopping boards, for example, how to roll pastry. And the basic idea of when you cook something, cook too much, and then you can make the excess into a pie for another meal. So, yeah, it's a good book, and there's lots in it.
Did you try it? You said you tried some of the recipes.
Yeah, I tried making a short pastry and then using that to make smoked mackerel rolls. Mm. And they were really good. And then, I don't often sort of multi-buy, but in the farm shop they were selling 4 partridges for £10. So I bought them, and then I thought, what on earth am I going to do with them? So I actually made partridge pie using a Jane Grigson recipe for what to put in the pie, but using Andrew's recipe for the pastry. And it worked really well. And it's unusual, because one of the things he says about making pastry, you know, a lot of people say the butter or the lard should come straight from the fridge.
Right.
He says it should be at room temperature, but cut up. And the reason is, you know, obviously you've got to keep things cold, but if it's at room temperature, you can mix it much faster than if it's cold from the fridge, so the heat from your hand isn't affecting it as much. And then he has also been experimenting, and I've never heard this before, of actually using butter or lard from the freezer and finely grating it, so it's almost, you know, well, so it mixes extremely quickly. And because it's grated, you don't have to do a lot of work. So there's some interesting ideas, and I think well-researched ideas. It's a good book.
I think it's a love letter to British pies. I think it's a sort of, you know, a kind of snapshot of our love of pies. And everybody loves a pie. I've not met anybody who doesn't like pies. And even if you're vegetarian, there's vegetarian pies in here. If you're wheat intolerant, I've got potato top pies in here. And pies blanket this nation, almost like a sheet of pastry, from Cornish pasties to pie and mash in London to pies, Scotch pies in the north. You know, everybody in Britain loves pie.
Do men follow instructions, though?
Food can be a bit like Lego, and you can either freestyle with it, or if you want to do it properly, you need to follow instructions. And if you're working with pastry, you cannot be that flamboyant. You've got to follow a few of the basic tips and guidelines, because otherwise you won't get a result. there's room to ad lib in things like, you know, fillings or size or those sorts of things. But when you're dealing with the basic kind of elements of pastry and the kind of proportions and reactions of the ingredients that make up that, you've got to kind of pay attention to the advice there.
And there are some interesting pies in there, aren't there? Some that I'd not heard of before. Bedfordshire clanger, Dartmouth pie.
Yes, Bedfordshire clanger. Well, that's an interesting one. I mean, that's one of those ones where it's basically meat at one end and fruit at the other. It's almost like your main course and your pudding in one complete pie. So you could have, say, pork or beef and onion at one end, and then there's a barrier in the middle, and then you have your dessert end at the other with apples and that sort of stuff.
Right.
So you can almost serve it with like gravy at one end and custard at the other. Yeah, that's an old traditional recipe dating back, oh, must be a couple of hundred years.
Can you still buy them?
No, not really. I mean, I think there's a bakery in Bedford itself that had a go at it, and that recipe actually comes from a friend of mine called Andy Bates, who is a TV chef, and he sort of remade it, and his features pears. But again, it's part of that whole kind of Melton Mowbray pork pie, Cornish pasty. You know, each region historically would have its own pie and would be made up of the things from that region and designed by the people in that region for specific purposes, either working down the mines or... A Melton Mowbray pork pie was designed for sort of snack post-hunting, and so the pastry had to be quite tough so it wouldn't get bashed about. There's a whole history there that I think that we've sometimes in our globalisation of the world have sort of forgotten about, and this book brings it back. And of course there's the massive medieval Christmas pies and things like that. You know, pies were... You had them on great occasions and you put in them the best of your stuff, and often you wouldn't really eat the pastry. It was almost like a kind of medieval Tupperware that would just protect the filling, and that would be broken off, and that would end maybe get given to the poor or something like that. A bit like a trencher, you know, a kind of old bread plate. And nowadays, the pastry is really, really important. We eat and enjoy that now, but not so much in historical times.
Of the ones in the book, which is your favourite?
I think if people are going to try one, and, you know, you need to get your head around it and have a real good go at it, it's the steak and ale. It's the classic. And the technique was actually given to me by my butcher in Saffron Walden. What's interesting about it is it uses two cuts of meat. So you use skirt beef, which breaks down. You cook that first, and it sort of... That completely breaks down. And then you put in the braising steak. You don't even have to seal it or anything like that. You put that in, and it creates this gravy that is just stunning. And that, because the thing is with a pie, you're basically saying, you know, if you make a pie for someone, I love you so much, I made a stew, I let it go cold, and then to make it even better, I put it back in some pastry and made it again. And that's, in this have-it-all age, giving somebody the gift of time and food is a very powerful and lovely thing. If you're going to attempt one, have a crack at that. You can take it in stages. I think with all forms of cooking, people try and do too much too soon, too quickly, without enough planning. And pies, because you can make the filling the day before, or you can make the pastry the day before, you can actually spread out the work over maybe, you know, a couple of days. If you're trying to do everything in half an hour because your mother-in-law's coming round, that's when people cut corners, make mistakes, things don't rest. Remember, a pie filling is better than it. Like a curry or something like that, it's better the next day because it's rested, the flavours have kind of got to work together, it's calmed down. And so you can actually use those sorts of things.
One of the many things I liked about the book was there were some interesting facts in there which are obvious, but I'd never realised them. So, for example, in a lot of respects, lard is healthier than butter.
Yes, lard. I mean, pastry made with lard will always be better than pastry made solely with butter, I think. But lard has none of the sort of healthy, glowing, you know, fields of buttercups and happy cows connotation of butter. But lard's actually really, really important in pastry, I think. I think it gives a flakier and also a more of a flavour element to it. So I tend to favour half butter, half lard, or a proportion of lard in my pastry. I think that works. People have forgotten just how good lard can be, but you give people a pastry made just with butter and a pastry made with lard and butter, and I think they'll always choose the latter.
But lard is becoming quite difficult to get hold of, isn't it?
It is. I mean, at my local supermarket, a range of butters, from economy right up to French fancy butters, goat butters, all this sort of stuff, only one brand of lard. So we've got to keep it. If you can get it from your butcher, if you can get the real stuff, it's brilliant stuff to bake with.
The thing that surprised me most, though, was the fact that lard contains more unsaturated fat than butter does.
Yes, because it, I mean, if you think about that, it's sort of squishier. So that would stand, that would be why that might be the case.
Yeah.
You know, we've forgotten, you know, the even the dripping jar, which our grandparents, you know, whenever you roasted meat, bread and dripping, and I'm getting to a stage now where I'm thinking, if I have a roast dinner, I'm thinking that dripping's going to be fantastic. It could be great in flavour and all this sort of stuff. And we've got a bit squeamish about animal fats, I think.
And another, I think, mistake that a lot of us make, I certainly do, and I hadn't realised it till I read your book, is that putting pastry into the fridge to chill and rest before you roll it, I always roll it into a ball.
Yeah, naturally you would. Roll into a ball, wrap in cling film, place in the fridge. That's the standard advice in a lot of cookbooks. But if you think about that, when it comes out of the fridge, you're just going to squash it flat and roll it. So it's probably better to squash it into a lozenge shape. That'll allow the cold to get into the centre quicker, because sometimes I've chilled pastry, and I found this out through trial and error, and the outside's getting quite hard. And when I've gone to roll it, the inside's still warm from, you know, or still pliable. And that then creates difficulties when you're trying to roll it out, because you've got hard pastry that won't roll and very squidgy pastry. So roll up your pastry, squash it into a sort of lozenge, bar of soap type shape, and you'll allow the cold to get to the centre quicker.
The book is about 188 pages.
It is 50,000 words.
Right. Is there anything you have had to leave out because of matters of space that you regret?
I mean, there's always going to be more recipes one could have added. And, you know, I quite like playing with different types of ingredients. I had to cut a lot of the history angle as well. I would have liked to... There's a bit at the back that kind of looks at the history of stuff. And I would like to have put in a bit more of the history or some more of the more unusual pie facts from around the UK.
Yeah.
But, yeah, a lot of that had to... The recipes have to take precedent. And so there is a rich, rich history going back, you know, hundreds of years for pies.
Yeah, some of it comes through in the book, doesn't it?
Yeah, I managed to get a soupçon in. The thing is with pies, most people have probably got enough ingredients to make pie in the house. They just don't think about it. So always cook too much roast dinner and make leftovers into a pie. You might have something on the turn in the fruit bowl, a few apples on the turn, done a bit of blackberry in with the kids. Well, there you go, that's a pie. You see all these 2-for-1 offers in the shops and you think, how am I going to use that? Bulk buy, think pie. That's my advice.
Can I just come back to the sort of the male orientation?
Yeah.
Are you not going to lose a lot of potential
well,
buyers?
I think that Haynes resonates particularly well with guys, and so they were quite keen to go for the men's pie manual. It's more aimed at the gentleman pie enthusiast. It's by no means blokey or laddie. It's more the sort of chap who kind of, you know, what is Bake Off and takes his food seriously and is interested in good food and wants to have a go. But it is totally accessible for ladies as well.
And did it take a long time to write?
It's about a year. I mean, the recipes took a lot of the recipes were involved in testing and shooting, and I finished them off just this summer, actually, and you can imagine how hot this summer was, just gone.
Yeah.
And there I was, you know, trying to roll out pastry, and it was 25, 30 degrees outside, and, you know, finishing them off like that. But, yeah, I'm kind of pleased with how it went and you know, looking at doing something else.
So are you working on something else
I've
now?
Got a few ideas in the fire, you know, a few other little sort of things. But you know, right now I just think that baking's so popular and so trendy, and we've seen a lot of the cupcake side of things and, you know, the kind of very kind of more fancy female kind of thing, and that's fine, and I like those things too. But I think that breads and pies and these, there's room for that as well. And we see on Bake Off that, you know, the popularity of baking is never been higher. And so I think that people want to have a go, but this is the book that people can buy and start doing that.
And that was Andrew Webb, and Andrew's new book, Men's Pie Manual, is now published.
Community radio in your city.
Follow us on Twitter at Cambridge 105.
Coming up later, we have a new cocktail from Aoife Maxwell, with a drink celebrating the onset of autumn, and our regular university and city food and drink news, and Gigi Perry will be joining us for that.
But our next feature is about the Horizon Community Cafe on Coldham's Lane. Matt, you popped by there this week?
Yeah, yeah. I met with Jane Thorpe, who runs the Horizon Cafe. This is a cafe that's also a council project, and it's to train people with learning difficulties so that they can find paid employment afterwards. So it's a cafe, but it has this very heavy community slant. Now, Jane has a real passion for cooking and a strong background in social care. One of her trainees is Ashley, and the snippet of music coming up is a nod to one of Ashley's favourite songs for when he and Jane are cooking away in the kitchen.
Community Centre didn't have a cafe a year ago, and the whole idea behind the project was to give people with learning difficulties the opportunity to gain work-related skills. So December last year, this cafe was built.
Hi, my name's Ashley. I come to Horizon Community Cafe on Mondays and Fridays.
Ashley, you chose this project because this is something that interests you. Of all the courses that you could have chosen, how did you get started in cooking? Do you remember how young you were when you started?
I was 19, long time ago, and I started cooking a lot. And then that was because I did Russia Street was with Dawn on a Wednesday, and we only do like 10:15 to 12:15. And then I used to do cooking at Cambridge Regional College, that was another one. And I used to work at Demonham's Restaurant, and that was used to be a work spins on two Mondays, and Barbara used to take me to there. And then now I decided to come here.
I love a bit of reggae in there, yeah. Mellow.
And what about Don't Turn Around?
As word.
Yeah. Ashley loves that one.
Yes.
We're a team, aren't we, Ashley?
Yes, we are teamwork.
We're all a team. So we make everything from scratch, like chocolate fudge cake from scratch. You're getting it as it's coming out of the oven, so it's really nice. And we do find people that come here to work don't want to leave because it's an opportunity for them to take some responsibility and socialise on more of a normal level, you know. Like, Ashley comes here to work. When he works in the CAF, he has all the responsibilities of an employee. So, yeah, it's nice to see, really. It's really nice to see them.
Now, how long have you been coming here?
I've been here 6 years now, and I really like that we have the kitchen now. Before, we didn't used to. And then with our guys working in here, and they get the chance of improving their skills.
So now the community centre is offering so many more opportunities.
Exactly, yeah.
We have 5-star food hygiene rating, and it's on the door as you come in. We are spot on with that stuff.
It's good in the kitchen these days. I mean, Jane does a good job getting things together here and keeps everybody happy.
Yes.
And she makes decent roast potatoes and gravy, which is not bad for a southerner.
It's lovely to be here on a Monday morning and have that gorgeous smell of a roast dinner that's just coming along. This is really good value, isn't it?
I mean, teas and coffees are 50p each, hot chocolate's 50p. You can buy a panini for £3, a slice of cake for £1, and that's fresh cake that's been made here. I think the thing is that we are very competitive with our pricing, and we've been very careful about our pricing to make sure it is accessible to everybody. But it is a big place where you can come with children, but it's not going to cost you an arm and a leg to eat here, and you're going to be eating healthy, fresh food.
I made sweet toy sponge, chocolate sponge, and mousses. We've also had crumble, have we? Crumble?
Yeah, we've made crumble quite a few times. Crumble's a favourite.
That's what I had last night for pudding.
It all depends on the season, actually, because in the summer, people want, like, cheesecakes and stuff like that. But then when the winter comes, they want treacle pudding with custard. So it warms up, you know?
It's good value for money now, anyway, you know.
Have you had any of the food yourself?
I've had a few little free gifts, and the cakes are amazing. Too good.
The kids.
The cakes.
The cakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very nice. Yeah, very good.
Shall we have a little tour around the kitchen now? One of the things that strikes me is it's so very lovely, large and airy. It's a great location to have this kitchen. You have full windows on either side, so you've got plenty of natural light and air coming in. But if we just have a look at the machinery now, because all of this is brand new for a start.
Yes, all of the equipment here was put in last year, is new.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got two big catering ovens. catering dishwasher, we've got panini maker, we've got two massive sinks and serving counters. It is a proper catering kitchen, and when you come and see it for yourself, you'll see that we really are a professional cafe.
Also, people can see you in operation as well. They can just
I mean, if you buy dinner here, you see us cook the dinner here.
And the food is first class, and it's fresh meat. It's beautifully served.
Yes, there's lots of variety of food here. I go for the lasagna, it's really nice, the roast dinner, the omelette.
And it's always very good value?
Great value, actually, for money.
More people should come here, then.
Yeah, definitely.
You like your beef well done, then, eh?
Yeah.
I like my beef medium rare, though, I do.
Do you?
I like it with a bit of iron on it.
A bit of iron?
I think what she's doing is amazing. It's amazing the workload she gets through, given the pressure she has, and it can be crazy in here. You never know what your day's going to be like. So I have utter admiration for Jane. She's not just holding her own, she's trying to improve it and grow it and make it a better experience.
The main objective of this project is to enable people with learning disabilities to gain skills to go back to employment. So Ashley could start here, but then he could go work in a cafe somewhere else. There's nothing saying that with the right support that Ashley couldn't be a manager of a cafe. You know, it's that kind of thinking, you know, they come in, they start off small, we're building them and building them and building them up, and then we're supporting them back into employment. So, you know, Ashley will earn his own money and be the driver of his own destiny, I suppose. That's what you could say. That's the whole point of this cafe.
Hello, my name's Fiona. I eat, say, maybe three times a day from Jane's kitchen, and I must say, she's always calm under pressure, and the food is always served beautifully, and it tastes delicious. I would recommend the general public to come here, because I know she caters to a variety of tastes here at Horizon, and we just really appreciate, as I say, her spirit, positivity and flexibility when it comes to delivering food all hours of the day between 10 to 2.
Very understanding. Put together a very good training programme for them, and they all love working with her. So, yes, I'm full of praise for Jade.
Yeah, Jane, she works hard enough. And what good about it as well is that she's educating some of the service users as well and giving them plenty of practice, and they all seem to love coming into the kitchen and doing a day's work, helping out. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, she's a good all-rounder, actually.
And I think more important is, like, Ashley and all the other people that work here, it's their cafe, they help to build it. It's only myself who's staff that's hired through the council, but the rest of the people that have made this, that have grown it from just selling cakes to selling dinners, are people like Ashley that have come. And I mean, Ashley does a work experience, so he doesn't get paid to be here, but he gains a qualification through it.
Yeah.
I think the free dinners have a lot to do with it, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to get a free dinner every Monday, because this year will be my first Christmas dinner with Horizon.
So everybody here will get to be part of the Christmas event. So for some people that maybe live in supported living, they won't get that. So it's nice that we can give them that, you know, and it allows them all to sit down together. You know, like a staff Christmas party, that's what it reminds me of. Everybody's there, everybody's drinking, everyone's having a laugh. It's really... It's kind of like the cafe, food is the heart of the home, but it's the same for everybody. So really, we just want to keep building this, and we need people to come in and purchase our dinners so we can keep giving more opportunities to people, and, you know, we can stay here then.
Well, thanks very much for your time, Jane. It's been great visiting you, and we are here at the Horizon Community Cafe, 285 Coldhams Lane.
That's right. Yeah.
Just by the roundabout. Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
I think there's a sign, a slogan in our base group is something, nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm. And I think enthusiasm is key, no matter what you have to do, you know, whether it's a big thing or a small thing. But if you attack everything you're given to do with enthusiasm, then, you know, the result is obviously you're going to get rewards, aren't you?
And there's loads of that here.
Yes, there is. You can feel it, feel the vibe.
Lovely, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that was Jane Thorpe, and she runs the Horizon Community Cafe. It's a lovely cafe situated by the roundabouts, and they do have a small number of the public that go there at the moment, but that's the people nearby who are in the know, or the local builders. But they have the capacity to cater for so many more. They'll do roasts, lasagnas, full English, chocolate and fudge cakes, pies, all top quality, all pucker, as Jane might say. And with Ashley, David and her other trainees, wish them all the best. They're doing a great job. And I hope you go for that Masters, Jane.
We are Flavour, and we're here live in the studio. And there's many ways to contact us. You can email while we're here. You can email studio@cambridge105.fm. You can text us on 07919 070490. We're available on Twitter at Flavour105. Or you can email, when we're not in the studio, flavour@cambridge105.fm.
Well, here we are in autumn, and one of the good things about that change in seasons is the fact that it inspires Aoife Maxwell to design a new cocktail. Here she is.
Aoife, a change in season, a change in cocktail?
Absolutely. I'm certainly feeling the change in the seasons. I don't know about you, but you know what's coming, but you suddenly start to feel a little bit down, a little bit low. There's this urge to hibernate. Well, that's certainly what I get anyway. And my cocktail trends have started to reflect that. And it's been on my mind as well to get out into the hedgerows and pick some slows for this year's batch of slow vodka or slow gin, which, you know, depending on your preference. So I thought, while I was, you know, making a long to-do list, including making slow gin, I would actually make a cocktail using last year's batch of, in this case, actually, slow vodka. And I just used vodka because probably that was what I had available. But I also quite like it because you get the flavour of the slows coming through a little bit better. But actually, you know, slow gin is also very nice because the botanicals in the gin do go very well with the slow. So, you know, I tend to make both. Just depends what I have available. But in this instance, we're going to spice it up a little with an extra bit of liqueur as well. So we don't necessarily need all the botanicals from slow gin. So let's start with a bit of slow vodka. I'm going to make this cocktail very simply. I'm really going to just build it in a glass, check that I'm happy with the flavours, and then pour it over ice and serve it over ice. I'm not going to do any shaking or stirring. Mm. This is, you know, we've got to conserve our energy. This is winter hibernation mode. Let's take it easy. So you can see the bottle here that I have of my slow vodka is a really, really rich ruby colour.
It's a fantastic colour.
When it's not held up to the light, I mean, it almost looks black, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
It's really rich.
Yes, it does.
Why don't you have a little taste, actually? Tell me what you think. I don't know if you're a connoisseur
of slow.
Well,
I'm about to drive to Oxfordshire, so it's going to have to be a very small taste. Oh, it's a lovely, lovely flavour. So, it's like damsons, actually.
Yes.
I mean,
and what's interesting is I don't really use much sugar in that. Now, some people would use a lot more sugar. I don't really use much at all. I've added a little bit extra at the end, but I don't tend to infuse my slows with sugar at the start. So I like to really play around with it at the end, you know, when I've filtered off
so
the
slows. So that you can get it right.
So I can get it where I want it to be. And I quite like it, that dry level. I think it works well. And, you know my methods. I like to be able to add the sweetness later, perhaps with a bit more flavour in the sweet component, so by making maybe a flavoured sugar syrup. And that's kind of what we're going to do here today. So I'm going to take some of my delicious slow. I'm going to take 30 mils. Even though it's early in the morning, the sound of that glugging sounds really inviting. And I'm just going to add it to a large glass or a cocktail shaker, just depending on what you have available. So the next ingredient that I'm going to use is this lovely Adnam spirit. So it's their winter spice liqueur from the Adnams Brewery in Suffolk. And I really like this. I have a little taste of this as well. It's almost like a supercharged gin. You know the way some gins are very botanically? It's like a gin with extra winter spices. So I really like this. I got this last winter, and it's a really nice liqueur. And I think it'll go well with the slows and add that extra spiciness. I'm just going to add 20 mils of that to the mixture. But, you know, if you didn't have any of this, you could maybe just add a nice strong gin, you know, it's quite heavy on the botanical, something like that, to give that extra kick. Or even some of the tobacco liqueur that we were talking about previously as well. That might be nice here too. Okay. So to round some of this out, I have one of my favourite simple syrups. So, as always, our simple syrup, one part water, one part sugar. This I've infused with ginger and some other spices, kind of a mixed spice, kind of a Christmassy winter blend.
Yeah.
Just
root ginger?
Yes. Yeah. So just 15 millilitres of that. Although my slow vodka isn't super sweet, it does have some sweetness, so we don't want to go too crazy. Into the mix. Now, to finish this off, I'm going to use this lovely Cambridgeshire apple juice, which I absolutely adore.
That's what, Watergull Orchards?
Watergull Orchards, yeah.
Cox, because they do different different apples, don't they?
They do, yeah. And actually normally I would tend to use one of their dry blends. This one's medium, but they didn't have any dry available. Mm. So I went for the medium. So I'm going to add a little bit of lemon juice just to freshen it up. Mm. But that's just a personal preference. Some people might prefer a sweeter juice. And if you've got a very sweet one, you may not need as much or any at all of the sugar syrup that we've just put in. So, you know, with this cocktail, with something so natural and unhomogenous like local apple juice, you really need to taste it and play around and see what it tastes like. But I really love this stuff. I think it's fantastic. And I'm going to use 50 mils of that. Now, because I couldn't resist, I have this apple cider bitters that I bought when I was in New York at Easter. So I couldn't resist adding some bitters, but it's not essential if you don't have them. It's a nice scientific dropper, this one. Put about 4 drops in there. Okay, I'm just going to taste it now. When I made this the other day, it definitely needed a squeeze of lemon, so I'm just going to check whether that's the case again. It tastes good. I am going to put a little bit of lemon in there. So instead of, you know, measuring out loads of lemon juice, I'm literally just going to give a squeeze into the glass. Much better. Okay, tasting good. Right, so we're going to do a very simple build, just with a nice short glass and filled with ice. And I'm literally just going to pour the cocktail in over the ice. And it's really a beautiful pink colour. So the really dark ruby red of our sloe has been diluted down a bit, but it's come up a beautiful autumnal colour.
It is a lovely colour.
So yeah. I'm going to garnish it with a few sloes that I actually saved from last year in my freezer, and I just saved them for the purpose of cocktail to decorate.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that is delicious.
It's like autumn medicine. It's guaranteed to make you feel better and make that change in the season. That little bit easier, I think.
Yeah, that's lovely. Okay, can you give us a quick resume?
I certainly can. So we've got 30 mils of sloe vodka or gin, 20 mils of our Adnam spiced winter liqueur, 15 mils of simple syrup flavoured with ginger and spices, 50 mils of local apple juice, a couple of drops of apple cider bitters, and a squeeze of lemon juice.
So it's, yeah, and it's lovely.
Excellent. Wonderful. I'm glad you like it.
I do. I wish I could have all of it.
That sounds like autumn in a cup and everything good about it.
Yeah, it really was. It looked great and it tasted great. And, you know, the danger with cocktails is you just want more. Well, I just want more. Anyway, you can read about that and other Aoife Maxwell cocktail creations on her blog, sweetpeasandsours.com.
On to the food and drink news now, and there is a lot of it. So here is Gigi Perry to start us off with news from the university.
To begin another year of blind tasting, Cambridge University Blind Wine Society are holding their welcome and introductory session tomorrow evening at 8 p.m. and again at 9. For a special discounted price of £5, it's usually 14, you can expect to cover the basics of wine tasting, from understanding its elementary components to familiarising yourself with some classic aromas, and then putting these skills into practice to identify 2 common wines. This session only runs once a year, so make sure you don't miss out. And it's taking place in the Burt Room at Queen's College, and tickets are on sale via their website, cubwts.soc.srcf.net. And Cambridge University Wine Society also have a very exciting tasting lined up for Tuesday, the 21st of October. They're treating us to an all-extensive tour of Australian wine, spanning regions and grape varieties. You can get a taste for the Hunter Valley with some amazing vintages before travelling south with key whites and detouring to the Adelaide Hills with some full-bodied reds. The tasty journey takes place at Peterhouse College's Upper Hall, and tickets can be found online at their events page, srcf.ucam.org/CUWS, and it's important to book early to avoid disappointment. Cambridge Food Cycle are launching their soon-to-be regular student night on Monday the 27th of October at 7:30 p.m. at Emmanuel United Reformed Church. The Society are looking for students to get involved in a subcommittee, so if you're interested in helping run the event and others like it, and there's more to follow, email hs551@cam.ac.uk. And if you missed out on the Food and Drink Societies at the Freshers' Fair last week, do check out the Cambridge Students newspaper this week, as it has full details of some of the delicious opportunities on offer and how to get involved.
Thanks, Gigi. And in the city food and drink news, first, a change to an event we mentioned on the last programme. Jack's Gelato and Steak and Honours joint event, which was been today, has now been put back to the 12th of November. Sign up to @flavour105 on Twitter for more information when we get it.
In the meantime, you can enjoy Jack's Gelato at Nord's in Sussex Street, and Steak and Honour will be at Kettle's Yard until 4 p.m. today, that's in Castle Hill. Their other van will be at the fundraiser for the Mill Road Festive Lights, which runs until 3 p.m, and that will be at Ditchburn Place off Mill Road. Tonight, they'll be at the Flying Pig in Hills Road from 7 to 10 p.m.
Lots of beery events happening this weekend. The Camera Oktoberfest is on now. It opened yesterday, it finishes tonight. It's in the University Social Club on Mill Lane. There are beer festivals also at the Cambridge Blue in Gwydir Street, and that's until tomorrow, with American and Dutch craft beers, real ales, and a selection of traditional ciders. And there is also one at the Free Press in Prospect Place.
And next Thursday, you can meet Green King's top brewer at the Alex in Gwydir Street. And we should mention, too, the reopening of the Rupert Brooke pub in Grantchester, which is looking very good.
On to new places opening. Nana Mexico was reopened yesterday, the one on Regent Street. And after a major refit, I walked by yesterday, looks quite nice. Bread and Meat is opening in Bennett Street on the 3rd of November. Relevant Records, a new vinyl record store in Mill Road, next to Cutlax, opens next month and will have a cafe. And Five Guys, the American burger and fries chain, opened this week in the Cambridge Leisure Park.
Apple Day is being celebrated on the 26th of October at the Botanic Gardens. It's £3 plus the normal admission charge to get in, but once you are in, there will be a collection of really unusual apples to try before you buy, including Allington Pippin, Belder Boscoop, Court Pondu Plat, Pitmaston Pineapple, and Ross Nonpareil.
In addition, experts from the East of England Apples and Orchards Project will be offering a pruning and care advice service. You can also get your own apples identified, so if you take along 2 to 3 apples from, say, each mystery tree, they will help to get you accurate identification. And there will be cakes, apple juices and ciders from local producers to sample and buy, together with cheeses, honey and other lovely local produce to eat with your apples. You can pay at the gate or on the day, or to avoid the queues, pick them up in advance from the same place.
On the 13th of November at Sticky Beaks in Hobson Street, Ursula Farinho hosts an event that includes oil tasting and a 4-course meal. It costs £35 and tickets are available from Sticky Beaks.
News about two cookery book events. Toppings, the excellent bookshop in Ely, will be hosting a cooking demonstration by none other than Yotam Ottolenghi at the Octagon, Ely Cathedral, on the 24th of November at 7:45. It's £10 and amazingly entitles you to £10 off plenty more, his new book, if bought on the day or beforehand.
Meanwhile, Jack Monroe, a.k.a. A Girl Called Jack, will be at the Cambridge Literary Festival on the 30th of November. That's at 4 p.m. to talk about food and politics. Her new book, A Year in 120 Recipes, is about to be published.
And on the subject of books, Bidwell's, the Cambridge estate agent, is 175 years old this year and is publishing a cookery book to celebrate, containing 175 recipes. The book is £10 and is due out at the beginning of November, so look out for it.
A couple of wine tastings coming up. Bacchanalia have a tasting of 80-plus wines on the 7th of November at the NCI Club in Holland Street, just off Victoria Road. It costs £12, payable in advance at any of their shops.
And finally, on 7th of November, Noel Young Wines has a tasting of Dog Point wines, and that's at 7:45 p.m. There are 30 places available, and it costs £15. I should think it will sell out. It will be a very interesting night. Ivan Sutherland and James Healy from Dog Point will be there, celebrating their first 10 years, and they'll be looking at their new wines but also comparing them with some of their old vintages. Bread and Cheese will follow the tastings, and I must ask Tom Lewis if he's going, because I'm certainly very tempted. Anyway, it's at the Cottage, 52 High Street, Trumpington.
And that marks the end of this edition of Flavour. You can enjoy it all over again by listening to a repeat tomorrow at 7 a.m. or the podcast, which should be available next Tuesday. You can find it on the Cambridge 105 website, where the podcasts of previous editions can be found as well.
Remember that you can keep in touch with Cambridge Food and Drink News by following Flavour on Twitter, @Flavour105.
Coming up next is Bookmark. This week's guest is poet and author Joanne Lindberg. Joanne's memoir, The Woman Who Thought Too Much, chronicles her life living with obsessive-compulsive disorder. And her third poetry collection, The Oxygen Man, explores the issues raised by her brother's suicide. They also talk with poet Claire Crossman about how she's inspired by a landscape, and renowned novelist Esther Freud explains what drew her to the story of architect and artist Charles Rennie Mackintosh's time in Walberswick, as featured in her new novel, Mr. Mac and Me. At 2 o'clock, Neil Whiteside's back. He's meeting Adam Norsworthy, co-founder and lead singer with the Mustangs, one of the top UK blues bands.
Thanks to all of our interviewees today. Our next episode is in 2 weeks' time on Saturday, the 1st of November. We hope you can join us then. So for now, it's goodbye from Flavour.
Bye. Bye.